Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry number 865.1C0924, certificate number 28924, the Olympic Marathon of 1904.
Do you like the Olympics, John? Are you an Olympic fan? Do you generally have Olympic fever every 2 to 4 years?
When I was a kid, I was hugely into the Olympics, the Leroy Neiman era of
florid,
expressionistically painted Olympics. I think I'm exactly the age that does not remember the Munich Olympics, but does remember the
76?
The 76
Montreal.
Montreal. Yeah.
Nadia.
That's right. Nadia Comaneci.
I'm a little younger than you, and I have an Olympic gap because of Jimmy Carter boycotting in 1980. So I, there's this 8-year Olympic wasteland, which was harder on the athletes than for me, but I'm a victim too, I guess.
Well, harder on the whole history of the Olympics. But you remember when the Olympic year was winter, summer in the same year.
Yeah. And that actually seemed, I guess in hindsight, it does make more sense to shake it up.
Yeah, but I don't like it. I preferred it when the Olympics were like, it's 1976 and it's going to be Olympics all year.
I do too. But is that just because that's how it was when we were kids and everything's better when you're kids?
Well, or just that the Olympics every 2 years makes it seem like
it's less
special.
It's
always the Olympics.
Yeah, it's the Olympics again. It's right. Like, is it my turn to take out the trash again?
Well,
is it the luge again?
Then it's like X Games, and there's so many different Olympics now.
Also, the fact that the Winter Olympics are kind of the lame ones means that every 2 years you've got, it's the Olympics this year. Oh, but they're in, Sochi. These must be the lame ones.
Wait a minute.
It's in a city I've never heard of.
I absolutely refuse to accept that the Winter Olympics are the lame ones.
No, the Winter Olympics are the lame ones.
No, I grew up in Alaska. The Winter Olympics were the only ones we cared about.
Like, they have the real sports, like biathlon.
I have actually had friends in the Olympics.
Wow.
But they're all from the ski sports. Like Tommy Moe, who won gold for the USA in the giant slalom and downhill.
Yeah, I think that's right.
He was like a guy that I grew up skiing with. We actually went to see Metallica together.
I didn't realize this would be such a great chance for you to name drop if I would insult the Winter Olympics.
Listen, if you get a chance to name drop a gold medalist, you take that opportunity.
I feel like that's evidence that winter is lamer, because I don't hang out with, Jamaican long distance runners, because the summer races are actually a little more elite. These are not just bums from your childhood running around. These are actual athletes in real stadiums, so you don't know them.
I see how it is. But just being friends with an Olympian sort of denigrates the whole.
But Tommy Moe is a pretty good one. It's not like some random third guy in a bobsled team. Like,
no,
he was legit.
He was on our
celeb ski
team, and he's a couple years younger than me. But even when I was 12 and he was 10, he was visibly a better skier than anybody else. He just took a different line down the mountain and just had a lot of confidence on the skis.
The first Olympics I remember as a kid was 84 in LA, and it was an American homegrown Olympics. So everybody went nuts.
Yeah, but also the Russians boycotted it. It's not a legit Olympics.
But do you remember the story? Like, where I remember this personally. We would go to McDonald's a lot, and McDonald's had a giveaway at the time where you'd get maybe a scratch card or something. And if the US medaled in the event on the card, you'd get a free McChicken or a free Big Mac or something. And they had done all the cards in all these events that we never meddled in. Because, yeah, what are the odds that we're going to do anything in women's swimming against these muscular Soviet block types? And then when all the Eastern European, all the iron countries, Warsaw Pact countries boycotted, suddenly McDonald's had to give away McNuggets hand over fist, and they just lost millions.
Oh, that's genius.
On this promotion.
Well, like the Leroy Neiman thing was also a McDonald's promotion. Leroy, for those not in the know,
I don't think we should assume that these Futurians we're talking to have Leroy Neiman, Michael Jordan posters on their bedroom wall.
I have to assume even maybe the giant insects of the future are still into Michael Jordan. I doubt they're into the oil painting stylings of Leroy Neiman.
Could his colorful splashes of paint survive any apocalypse? I guess only our listeners know for
so
sure.
So he was a sports, this is a thing that doesn't even exist in our current time, which is a famous sports painter.
Who are your 10 favorite sports painters, John? I like Reggie Jackson Pollock and...
Yeah, he was a big deal, and he did an entire series of paintings, like very kinetic paintings, sort of like in a not impressionistic, really, because they were sort of also pretty realistic. But
yeah, it's like the faces are actually like photorealistic, but then they've got all these sort of
splotches
of color and lens flare kind of a vibe going on.
So he made these paintings for the Olympics, and then they were given away, or maybe they were on placemats. No, they were like prints. You'd go to McDonald's, buy a Happy Meal, and get a Leroy Neiman print.
That's a funny part of our childhood, when you would go to fast food and get a glass or something, or go to the service station and come home with a glassware or flatware or something.
I mean, here in my house, I have maybe half a dozen to a dozen banks, little piggy banks, that are in the shape of houses or cars. And you would get those when you open an account at a bank. They'd give you a piggy bank shaped like a thing that you were presumably saving to buy.
And that works on a very small segment of the population, but it sure seems like you might be one of those people.
Well, yeah.
If you have dozens of these still.
I mean, back then you could buy a house by putting a quarter every once in a while in your little house-shaped piggy bank.
Sure. At the end of the month, you can go buy a $10,000 starter house in Levittown. I feel like we may have gone somewhat far afield from the Olympic Marathon of 1904.
Well, the Olympic Marathon of 1904 is kind of it's like a foundational moment in the modern Olympics.
Well, we're talking about, the modern Olympics as a splashy media phenomenon, just a multi-billion dollar thing with lights and fireworks and flags and incredibly elaborate, lavish opening ceremonies and
Muhammad Ali,
Bob Costas, and John Tesh music, probably. I don't even know. But, it's this massive spectacle, unparalleled spectacle, to make the 4th of July look just lame. And that was not always the case.
Well, and it's also like an event of global unity, right? The countries from all around the world come to participate in what is supposed to be the non-commercial side of sport.
Which is kind of a joke now. I mean, nothing's more jingoistic than the Olympics. Nothing has more money pumped into it.
Right.
Nothing has more, pampered big name athletes.
But as an athlete, traditionally, you weren't allowed to be a professional, right? You couldn't profit from your athleticism and compete in the Olympics.
Right. That's the original Olympic tradition. And I think even in our time, I don't know if the Olympic movement has survived to our listeners are, but in our time, it's hard to imagine the Olympics as a little struggling startup. Huh. But that's essentially what it was at the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, let me ask you this, right? The Olympics are, and again, for the Futurians, it may seem like time is compressed. Time is a flat circle. It may feel very compressed between what we call ancient Greece and what to you is ancient
St. Louis.
Ancient America.
Yeah, to
right?
them, they're like, well, it's probably, they probably, these people knew each other.
Sure. It's just like
the Spartans were in St. Louis.
Shakespeare, knew St. Augustine, which he did.
Stegosauruses and Tyrannosaurus rexes were further apart in time than we are from Tyrannosaurus rexes.
Is that right?
Yeah. More millions of years elapsed between the Stegosaurus and the T-Rex than between us and the dinosaurs.
I see things all the time where the two are represented as sharing an ecosystem.
Sure, they're just hanging out in children's books and Fantasia and whatnot. In fact, it would be like you and I just, hanging out with trilobites.
Interesting. I feel like I am hanging out with trilobites sometimes, but I'm a rock musician.
Are you the guy that goes into the Goes into the bar and is like, look at all these trilobites here tonight. Let's go somewhere else.
So, but the Olympics, the original Olympics, it's a Greek word. And the original Olympics were a Greek event, the sort of like a amateur sporting event. Sure.
They loved athletic events in the nude, those Greeks.
In the nude.
They would look forward to this all year. They'd leave their crops and come to the big stadium and have races and whatnot.
And then there was a 2 millennia interregnum, and then we began the Olympics again, and it seems like one of these things that maybe some boosters somewhere, some guys in straw boaters,
exactly,
said, like, you know what we need?
Rich guys at some kind of crew event.
We should bring back the Olympics.
They're all talking through megaphones at each other. Get that out of my face. It's funny to think that maybe the only reason we know about the ancient Olympics is because there was a marketing push in our century. Like, did Shakespeare know about the Olympic Games?
Interesting.
Maybe it wasn't even famous, you know? Maybe you had to be a classical scholar to be like, the Greeks used to get together and throw javelins in a stadium. It was nuts, you know?
When was the first modern Olympics?
1896.
Okay, so pretty recent, or pretty recent history to someone in 1904.
Sure. These would have been, I think there was some kind of... No, this would have been the third one, I think.
Wow.
And I was in Greece last year, and one thing I didn't know is the Athens Olympics in 1896, they brought it back in its original home, Athens. They were a big splashy thing. The Greeks won some medals. They loved the idea that their culture was being celebrated on the world stage. But then, like, 1900 and 1904 were, like, barely Olympics.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they did not have any of even the minimal pomp and circumstance and laurel wreaths of the 1896 event. And it wasn't until... Athens held a 10th anniversary celebration in 1906, so the Olympics kind of got their groove back.
Oh, I get it.
So in 1900, in Paris, I want to say, and 1904 in St. Louis, the Games were really just sort of an athletic side event to the World's Fair. Like, some kind of expo was going on that year, and they were like, well, let's have a tennis tournament too.
Right.
And so that was the Olympics that year.
And the St. Louis World's Fair was a big event in 1904. It was the 100th anniversary of the Louisiana Purchase.
Yeah, and so now we look back and we're like, wait, the Olympics were in St. Louis?
Yeah.
Like, it seems a little weird, right? It seems like maybe, you know, can you imagine if today the Olympics are announced and it's like Fresno or whatever? But
somebody needed to pick up the slack, and this was like the big event for St. Louis.
St. Louis was probably a more of a major world city at the time, and it was the departure place for the West, right? It was... you know, that's why the Gateway Arch is there. That's the Jefferson Expansion National Monument. That's like where America started to grow.
Right. And it's central within the Louisiana Purchase.
Yes. And so, you know, to celebrate the 100th anniversary of America doubling in size or whatever, they hold a World's Fair in St. Louis. And just as they'd done in Paris, they have an Olympic, like a sideshow. Like,
they staple it to it, huh?
Yeah, and there's all this weird, so here's how little it was. Like, in Paris in 1900, I guess, there's a story about an American woman who sees an ad for a golf tournament in the paper. She's some socialite type, some Henry James young thing who golfs in Sarasota in the winter. And she's like, oh, mother and I will go to the golf tournament. So they go and golf 9 holes, and she wins. Margaret Abbott wins this golf tournament and feels, you know, I'm sure very good about herself. I'm sure she gets a crystal bowl or something. She goes to her grave not knowing that she's an Olympic medalist. She's America's first woman gold medalist. And she died in the 50s, like, never even knowing.
No.
She thought she had just done this one day golf tournament she saw on the paper.
And when was this discovered, or when was she rehabilitated as America's first gold medalist?
I think pretty recently, you know, sports nerds, you know, assembling complete lists of medalists in Olympic history are like, wait, there was golf that year. Wait, there was women's golf that year. Who is this person?
Wow.
And they find out that Margaret Abbott never, you know, they tell her descendants, hey, your mom was the first gold medalist. And they're like, wait, what now? So that was the Olympics. You could compete and not even know you were in the Olympics.
Right. So the Olympic marathon, which is kind of the classic Greek, like the top sport of the Greek Olympics.
And it was invented for the 1896 Olympics. It was not a thing. They were just like, since we're here, let's reproduce this legendary thing where the guy runs back from the Battle of Marathon to Athens, and we'll make that our long distance race, and that'll be our big finale. So the marathon is essentially just invented as a gimmick, mm-hmm. as a marketing gimmick at the first Olympics.
It's like the Iditarod for people.
But the Iditarod is a real thing, right? It was run or something?
But the run from Marathon originally was a real thing. He ran back to Athens to say, we won!
It's Plutarch records it as history, but by that time it's just centuries later.
Right.
So who knows how reliable it'd be, like if I write the first account of Ponce de Leon doing something, like really how accurate is that going to be, Ken?
Plutarch was as far away from the Battle of Marathon as the Battle of Marathon was from trilobites.
A lot of people don't know this, but Plutarch was a T-Rex. He had to hold his pen and little his stylus in little flimsy arms. That's why we have so little of his writing.
So, but the Olympic or the marathon in 1904 also had a kind of sideshow aspect.
Yeah, it was like this sort of hastily thrown together golf tournament. This was not some world class thing with prelims and heats and whatnot. You know, it was just like, who wants to run 26 miles in St. Louis? And the distance had not been fixed, by the way. Back then, you know, today you see all these a-holes with 26.2 stickers on their cars. You know,
like, oh, is that what that means?
Did you just think that was...
I thought it was a biblical reference. It was something to do with like that, what their tire pressure was.
You're like, if I knew more about Jesus, I would... Their tire pressure, yeah.
It's like, I'm running 26.2.
I'm very proud of my low tire pressure. My other tire is also an honor student. No, that's the length of the modern marathon. It's 26 miles, 385 yards. But that's
I suddenly don't like those Subarus even more now.
But that's not the actual distance from marathon to Athens. Like it in the early years of the marathon, it was just like, let's mark a course and it would be roughly 25 or 26 miles. I think it was standardized in London in 1908.
Wait a minute. We're running out of O's. It had to be
408. Is it 08 or 1912? At the London Olympics, let's say.
Yeah.
The course got a little longer because of where the royal box was going to be. I think like the royals wanted to sit at the other side of the stadium with a better view. And, you know, in typical aristocratic fashion, it's like, yes, let's make those Greek men run a little farther to get to us.
Because they want to end right in front of the royals.
Right. That's the finish line.
Well, and they probably sat on that side so the sun wasn't in their eyes.
I'm sure it's something like that. There's even a legend about the start of the race where they moved the box so the princess of Wales could like hear her baby crying from a window in Buckingham Palace or something. Like these guys literally would not walk across the room to...
That does seem a little bit like a legend rather than... But all right, I'll give it to history.
As Plutarch wrote about the Princess of Wales's baby. So by this Olympics, it was just a you know, roughly 26-mile course. There was no scientific accuracy. And apparently it was just a nightmare experience.
Well, so who were the competitors, if not like professional marathon runners?
It wasn't just contest winners. Like there were some people who had, you know, won or finished highly in the Boston Marathon or the New York Marathon. Apparently in the wake of the Athens Marathon 1896, some city marathons had started up.
Oh, so the Boston Marathon is older than what we're talking about here.
Sure, yeah. The big American marathons predate this. So there were some people who at least knew they could run 26 miles and had done so in the last few months. But others were just sort of like, well, sure, I'll try that. Guys, like there was a bricklayer, you know, one of our heroes here is a bricklayer named Fred Lors, who had like won a 5-mile foot race and was like, oh, great, you qualify for the marathon. Just do that again 5 times, basically.
He'd never run 26 miles, presumably, in his life.
I don't know. I don't think so. There's another guy, Felix Carbajal, is a mailman from Cuba who decides to become a long distance Olympic racer.
This is the guy that showed up in long pants, right?
Oh yeah, that's true. He he gets to New Orleans, and I think he loses all his gear like in a dice game. Like, is it, like apparently New Orleans has not changed at all. Like within 10 minutes of arrival, he immediately gets fleeced, and he shows up for the marathon in like, you know, looking like some shabby Italian man from a neorealist movie. You know, he's got like a button-down shirt and a jacket and long pants. And
I'm watching you now, and you're imitating a guy with a stick over his shoulder and a little bundle, like a bindle tied at the end.
He has a bindle for some reason, a polka dot bindle. Like, why do you even have that? And I think the story goes that one of the American racers, you know, they didn't have spare clothes to give him, but they took his long pants and cut them with scissors so that he at least had shorts to run in. Oh, wow. Because it was just mercilessly hot this day. It's St. Louis in the summer. I don't know if you have any experience. But...
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit to Futurians. St. Louis it's in the middle of our continent. It's probably like on the edge of an inland sea in your day.
We don't know.
We don't know. But I'm.
It could be at the edge of the meteor crater. It could be at the center of the dirty bomb. We don't know. Sorry, Cards fans.
But it was a city that was renowned for its extremely hot, humid summers, and also unpleasant winters.
I think the heat and humidity were in the both in the 90s for this race. It's you can see why we don't have the Olympics in places like St. Louis anymore.
Yeah.
That's just funny to me. It's like, do you remember when Ted Turner had those like vanity Goodwill games or whatever?
Sure.
And they'd just be in weird places.
We had one here in Seattle, didn't we?
Oh, did we?
Yeah, I think we had a Goodwill game.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just like La Paz, Bolivia, you know, or whatever. Come to Warsaw. So it's, you know, it's just, but in the old days, the Olympics could just be in Antwerp or something. Who knows?
Right. So you've got this ragtag group of people that are just like lining up on a like a chalk line somewhere.
Yeah, and there was really no dedicated course. I mean, the runners had, you know, they sort of sketched off this path, but I think they wanted to make it like the final level of a video game. Like they wanted it to be exciting. So the course is seven hills.
Just like the famous Rome, seven hills of Rome.
Is St. Louis hilly? I wouldn't have thought of it as a seven hill kind of a city.
Well, the Mississippi River flows through St.
Louis. Sure, you got the banks of the Mississippi.
And the hills are not, you know, we in the West, there are some requirements what qualifies as a hill.
Is that true? There's a
committee? You're not going to call something a hill that's just like a bump. But St. Louis is, let's say, rolling hills. It's not like Pittsburgh where it feels like it feels hilly there.
I feel like I've only been down by the river. But apparently this course was very grueling. Seven hills and just running through traffic. People just dodging streetcars and little boys pushing hoops with a stick. You know.
Yeah, a guy on Newsies. A large bike. What's a large tire bike called?
Right, the penny farthing bike with one big wheel and one small. Yeah, so it's just like that. It's like the street scene from the flashbacks in Godfather Part 2, but then a marathon comes through that. So not super convenient because it was just like, and nobody knew. You have to imagine it was not, you know, right. Something everyone would be like, oh, hey, it's marathon day. Like right. Nobody really knew what was going on. They knew the World's Fair was going on and there was all this crazy ethnic dancing and pole climbing, all this weird cultural exhibitions, probably super racist, I can only assume.
I think conventional contemporary thought about the St. Louis Expo was that it was the heyday of the... what would you call it? The imperialist cultural anthropology years where they had savages come and do their native dance.
Put your hair in a bone. We don't do that. Yeah, you do now.
Right. And I think people from kind of all around the world in different, bringing people from different cultures, but sort of doing that like loincloth, reconstruct their quote unquote village out of straw. And then they would just sit there like, an exhibit,
like it's a zoo, basically. It's terrible.
So there's a lot of revisionism about how bad the 1904 fair was, just because it was guilty of these real like imperialist crimes.
The most racist World's Fair. That's St. Louis is still proud to this day.
Well, there were a few racist World's Fairs.
Maybe they were all super racist.
Pretty racist back then, but interestingly. The St. Louis World's Fair was also the debut. I think at the time, the anthropology stuff was not what people cared about. It was the debut of...
It's a food. Is that right?
No.
Oh.
It was the first display of private automobile. The first time that anyone had ever seen a car.
Wow.
That you could conceivably buy. It was, you know, the Wright brothers flew their first flight in December of 1903. So this was the introduction of powered flight was on display here.
That's funny that the airplane is invented and many people have not seen a car. That's interesting how close they are.
Yeah, right at the same time. Huh. This was the St. Louis Street World's Fair was the introduction of the electric streetcar, which didn't exist prior to this. Streetcars were pulled by horses.
Oh, something. Really? There's no powered streetcars? Not even?
Well, or maybe coal. But
that seems weird.
That does seem weird. It was the introduction, I think, of the radio. Like, this was an incredible moment in history where all these... Oh, the X-ray machine. Like, you know, we
hey kids, come to the fair. There's going to be an X-ray machine.
We forget that, like, the electric light and gasoline powered cars and airplanes and dirigibles and X-rays and radio, like, it all kind of happened at once. This was like the Thomas Edison years, where we made enormous strides, technological strides. And so I think this expo was, it was a big deal for people because they were wandering through these exhibition halls and it was one miracle after another. I think there was actually like an air race between an airplane, a dirigible, and a guy with tissue paper wings flapping and like a balsa wood airplane. And there, I think the requirement was that they, it was like, who can do this course at an average of 14 miles an hour? And nobody won. It's like nobody could manage it. Like there's a guy in a dirigible and a guy with pedaling a bike with, you know.
It's like a Hanna-Barbera cartoon. Was it that Snidely Whiplash guy? Was he like in the dirigible trying to puncture the biplane wing or whatever?
Dudley Do-Right again.
And then the dog or whatever. Oh, no. Snidely Whiplash is the Dudley Do-Right guy. Muttley is the... Who's the guy that owns Muttley?
Well, Muttley is... Oh, not Muttley.
Muttley's the dog that's like...
Yeah, no, you're thinking the Bullwinkle dog was like Poindexter or something. He had glasses and he knew everything.
Of Sherman and Peabody.
Right.
No, I'm thinking of the evil Hanna-Barbera guy. Like he wears aviator glasses.
Oh yeah, yeah. And he's
Dick
kind of,
Dastardly, not Snidely Whiplash.
He wears like a purple hat, right? He's kind of like he's super fly.
He's like yeah. You mean Dick Dastardly?
Dick Dastardly and Muttley.
Yeah, Dick Dastardly is he's got his look is sort of half those Magnificent Men and those flying machines and half like 70s pimp. Mm-hmm. It's a look that has aged really well. Well, we should get to the actual marathon.
Why don't we take a short break for our sponsors from the past?
Just what I was going to say, John.
Okay, so you were saying the actual marathon.
So the cars that had just been invented, there actually were cars following along in the race the on this hot, humid day, kicking up dust. And the organizer of the marathon apparently... he's some kind of Joseph Mengele type. He wanted to experiment on the runners. So there's almost no water stations. There's not a bunch of people giving out orange slices like today. There's like a water station like halfway through and then another one near the finish line.
What kind of experiment is that?
To see what happens to a bunch of Cuban bricklayers and mailmen if you don't give them water and make them run 26 miles. Like, I honestly think it's like the limits of the human condition. Let's see what these specimens can do, you know?
Oh, right.
We still call athletes fine specimens, but to this guy, like, he was like, they're actual specimens.
So he's riding alongside in a car, like, drinking cold water out of a jug and, like, refusing it to them?
He's got a clipboard and a white coat. He's taking notes. You know, and he's just very interested in dehydration and stuff. And I guess he wants to see it in action.
Everybody needs a hobby.
Hobbies include dehydration. The race almost immediately just goes terribly. You know, all this dust is getting kicked up. So the runners are breathing in dust and their lungs even start to hemorrhage.
Ugh.
Yeah. Like, so people are just coughing up blood on the roadside. They're dodging again, everything, streetcars, foot traffic. There's a bunch of, South Africans. I think some of these cultural exhibition guys have joined the race, and one of them just gets immediately chased off path by a mile by a pack of wild dogs. You don't see that a whole lot in the Olympics today.
Well, you don't even see it in St. Louis today. Like, how there's just packs of wild dogs running around?
Yeah, as you know.
I guess 1904.
Yeah, maybe they must be sort of on the outskirts of town, and there's just a bunch of you know, alley dogs from a cartoon, you know, the cat, right. The cat's pulling out the fish with the head and the skeleton.
Back when mice lived in little holes.
Exactly.
In a little perfect little arch.
It was a simpler time. Man and wild dogs lived in harmony, but not during this race. And Felix Carbajal, the Cuban mailman, you know, he's having a good time. Some people in a car, I think, give him apricots. And later he sees an apple orchard. And so he pulls off and starts eating apples. And then he doesn't feel, I think he lays down maybe to take a nap, and he starts to not feel so great. The, you know, eating green apples off the tree gives him cramps. So this guy just gets sick in an apple orchard.
You know, I have some firsthand experience of this. I went on a long walk, as we've discussed and will discuss many, many times. I went on a long walk one time and I stopped a few days and just gorged myself on tree fruit during the harvest time.
How does that work? Is it, were you looking around for an angry farmer holding a rake, or did you feel like you were?
No, you're kind of, you're out way out in the middle of nowhere walking along a road and there are orchards or there are trees kind of lining the streets, right? They plant fruit trees in places just as to cool the street, I guess.
Sure.
And there was a day where the cherries were just, there were these Rainier cherries just all the way across. This whole day I was walking across the Czech Republic and there were just cherries hanging down and I couldn't stop myself.
So Central Europe is full of, I guess Central European bakeries, it's always cherry. There's cherry dumplings and cherry pastries and they love cherries, huh?
Well, cherries and walnuts. There are walnuts everywhere too.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with cherries and walnuts.
That's
except that's if you eat like 15 pounds of cherries, which I did on one particular day. And I actually had to lay down in the grass because my stomach was so, I don't know if you've ever gorged on cherries, but it's a terrible, terrible feeling.
I have, you know, every summer here in the beautiful state of Washington, it's Rainier cherries for about a month and you really got to eat them. And sometimes when I take that too seriously, you know, you can't eat a lot of cherries if you're going to be far from a restroom, for example, and you were walking across the Czech Republic.
Yeah.
That must've been fun.
Famously no restrooms.
That's what it says on their, on their flag. It's on the seal.
But I was way out. There were no restrooms, but there, that's also an advantage to being way out because, you know, the earth is your restroom. Moving on.
The American favorite was not Fred Lors the bricklayer. It was a guy named Thomas Hicks who had won marathons in the past.
So he was a ringer. He was a legit marathoner.
There were a few actual marathoners in here. It wasn't just all, you know, like a reality show. It wasn't Big Brother.
Right.
Even he couldn't do it in this heat. You know, around the 9 or 10 mile mark, he's just begging for water. And of course, that's not how the course is laid out. His hand, even his coach, I guess, is in on the gag and won't give him water. Instead, what they start to do is they start to rinse out his mouth with a mixture of egg whites and strychnine of rat poison.
Why?
At the time, and I think maybe this is true, strychnine in small quantities was believed to be a stimulant.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's get, this guy needs a little boost. You know, this was the era where, you know, they give people heroin and like Bayer pharmaceutical company makes heroin and they're like, you feel like a hero, we'll call it heroin, you know, like,
right,
they didn't have the same enlightened attitude we do about the dangers of
put a, you know, just rub a little drugs. Mercury inside your nose
and you'll be off like a shot.
So they're actually feeding him strychnine. Why the egg whites?
I assume maybe just something moist and protein filled. I don't know. Boy. Like you got Rocky coming home and making the raw egg shake.
I want to go back to the past and just shake some people by the shirt collar.
This guy is running 26 miles for your pleasure and you're giving him raw eggs and rat poison.
Wow.
Just the poor guy.
So, but does strychnine actually, I mean, I don't want to start a whole new drug epidemic.
Right. Our listeners run to their
medicine cabinets or their,
under the sink. What do you got? Yeah, I don't want to encourage anybody running a race to immediately, you know, drink rat poison. But I think it's true that in small quantities, it's a short-term energy boost.
Uh-huh.
You know, like a Snickers.
Sure.
So that's what he is on, and he's not doing well. Fred Lors, the bricklayer, gets really tired out, and so he just hops in a car, a passing car, and rides for about 10 miles in a car.
What are these cars? I was under the impression that this was like the debut of, maybe these are some pre-car car.
It may have been the cars they're using to follow the path. You know, he just jumps in some kind of pace setting car when right. Nobody's looking. It's putting out clouds of steam.
the controls are just two levers with like grips on them.
Yeah, it's an old guy with a driving cap and driving gloves. Sure, hop in. Do you remember, in the 70s when a woman in the, was it the New York or the Boston? I think in the New York Marathon actually did just this and just took the subway.
Yeah.
Rosie Ruiz just hops in a subway and
shows up somewhere.
Shows up at the end. They're like, yay, she won. What a great time. That actually happened here too. Fred Lors got to the stadium first and was surprised to find everyone being like, you won. And he's like, yeah, I won. And it gets even to the point where Alice Roosevelt, President Roosevelt's daughter, is about to put the laurel wreath on his head. And, you know, some kid is like, I saw him getting a car. I don't know why the kid's Cockney in this story. But like,
he gets, was that a Cockney kid?
Yeah, you could tell from my amazing accent. So somebody rats him out and says, I saw this guy in a car, you know, going 10 miles in a car. And I assume Alice Roosevelt whips the laurel wreath away and turns up her nose and huffs off. But he very nearly got awarded as the winner.
Wow. I am embarrassed to say that this happened to me.
I can't believe you have a parallel story to this.
I'm afraid I do. I was on the cross-country ski team in high school. I was terrible at it. And we started a big race. And everybody, you go out into the forest, right? Nobody can see where you are. You go out into the forest. And I get immediately left behind. And I'm out there skiing by myself, completely behind. I mean, everybody just, even the worst skiers from other schools were like out of sight of me.
And you were not a great cross-country skier.
No, I don't have the build of a cross-country skier, and I don't have the competitive spirit either.
Can I interrupt to ask, why were you on the cross-country ski team in that case?
Well, I was trying to, you know, there's a social aspect to cross-country skiing.
That's why I do it.
Which is...
It's about the friends you make along the way.
At least in Alaska, right, the cross-country skiers are typically not the snowmobilers, if you know what I'm saying.
What's
right?
What's the class distinction here?
Well, the cross-country skiers are like wool sweater wearing.
Oh, that's the preppy sport?
Yeah, it's the preppy sport. It really is.
I don't know anything about Alaska preppies.
Yeah, cross-country skiing is a preppy environmentalist style. It's a leftist liberal kind of cultural
thing. There's a political divide there between really the snowmobilers is. And the cross-country
Even
skiers.
Between cross-country and downhill skiers... the cross-country skiers are the granola crunchers.
I see. And they found out you were out stumping for McGovern and made you join the...
Well, I there was this girl that I liked who was very preppy and she was very cross-country ski team. And I joined the cross-country ski team. Now, eventually, everybody agreed, the coach and everyone else on the team and I agreed that I would be better suited as the manager of the cross-country ski team, which I became... And I had a great time as the manager because I'd stand in a woolly sweater and as people would ski by, I'd go, yeah, pick it up. Good job.
That's a good gig.
It was a great gig. But when I was still racing, I got left behind. And at one point I was skiing along and I saw a bird's nest in a tree and I stopped and...
You're the mailman here.
Yeah, I climbed up and found this nest. And then, so now I'm carrying a nest.
You admitted the fact where you took the nest with you.
Well, it was like in the middle of winter. There's no birds.
Oh, it's not full right? of chirping baby birds.
No. And it's an old nest. But it was interesting to me. And so I grabbed the nest. And then I get lost. I'm out there. I'm lost. There are ski trails going in every direction. And it's a long race. It's way out in the boonies.
How long is one of these races?
Well, these were more than... Well, I guess it was a 10K race.
Wow.
Ski. And so I'm just kind of like out there... picking my path and I'm trying to stay on what I think is the arterial and I missed a turn and I'm skiing and I'm tired. I don't like skiing. And all of a sudden I hear behind me this like, shh, 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 shh. And I look over my shoulder and a guy goes zooming past me and he's like decked out in spandex and he's moving. And as he goes by me, he gives, you know, he kind of looks over his shoulder at me like, what are you doing? And I was like, durr. I mean, I was not in a spandex outfit, right? I was just in my jeans with a...
is that what the uniform is?
If you're a real hot skier, yeah. And then another guy goes past me. And then a third, really fast and looking at me weird. And I kind of realize what's happened. And then I hear this fourth guy behind me. And I come kind of over a hill, just lumbering. You know, I'm just lumbering. Come over a hill and there is the great big wide open sort of finish area, the banners, the crowd, the, you know, the finish line. And I just start to pour it on like, oh my God, you know, like really moving. And this guy behind me, the fourth guy, now it's a race between the two of us.
Sure. For fourth.
Right. And he's kicking it into gear and I'm kicking it into gear. And it looks like a race, like a legitimate battle to the finish. He noses ahead and gets fourth. I come in fifth, but that's still in the points. Like your school gets points.
So this was the finish line for your race.
This was.
I was wondering if you had wandered into some other race altogether.
Well, here's the problem.
Oh.
This was the second heat. And I was in the first heat. And so these were the top four finishers in the second heat. And I'd been out there long enough that they'd forgotten about me. And so I came in, I was fifth, and everybody like, oh my God, nobody on the team could believe it. How did you accomplish this? And it took about 20 minutes before somebody with a clipboard came over and said, you started in the first heat. That was like an hour and 40 minutes ago.
Had you figured it out ahead of the officials?
Well, clearly I was not. I mean, I watched all the skiers go away from me. I knew that I was not in the lead.
What kind of non-Euclidean course am I skiing here?
But I did, when the spirit of competition got in me, when it seemed like there's the finish line.
Sure.
You know, I didn't like pull over to the side and say, no, no, no. I raced.
Did you set down the nest?
No, I had the nest. I mean, it wasn't in my hand. It was like in my jacket. But no, I kept
the You have nest. A backpack on in the store? Well, Fred Lors also, you know, he says he does not come clean until he's caught. And right. He says, oh, it was just a joke, guys. You know, good one, right? So you could have tried that.
Well, yeah, I knew I was guilty too, but like, I mean, I don't know. It all came out in the wash.
Let's stop a minute for a word from our sponsors, and then in a moment, the results of this race. The marathon's not a great spectator sport, right?
Well, it's kind of like Grand Prix.
Sure.
You stand in one place and every 10 minutes, somebody goes by you really fast, but...
That's what I think about. You know, these little French towns, they all come out and watch a car go by and then two more cars and then another car.
Yeah. The Tour de France, same thing. It just like... And then you go back home, eat another bread.
You're not really getting a sense of the race.
No.
It's weird. There's literally no place you can stand and see what's going on. Except watching it on TV and getting a bunch of helicopter shots.
Right. Or at this 1904 St. Louis Expo, you could be in a dirigible. And you'd probably be going about the speed of the race.
That was the Google Earth of the time. You wouldn't look up a location on Google Earth. You would just get in your dirigible and float 1,000 meters in the air. I guess you could be in one of the cars taunting these people with water or sponges full of poison.
Right.
Or whatever they were allowed to have. But yeah, that was it. So Fred Hicks, our strychnine-filled marathoner, is not doing well. He's pale. You know, he can barely run.
Is he in the lead?
Yeah.
This condition?
Yeah. Yeah. He's doing very well. Apparently the rat poison is working wonders. Mm-hmm. He's not carrying a nest, for crying out loud. He's a serious runner. And I guess he hears that Hicks has been disqualified. And so like, you know, he thinks he's lost the race. Oh. And then it's like, that dude was in a car. You can still win, you know, through your poisoned haze, through your toxic haze. So he starts, you know, forcing himself to run. And they give him a second helping of rat poison, this time with some brandy to wash it down.
Oh!
A little chaser.
This is reminiscent of those early Tour de France's where all the guys were smoking cigarettes.
Oh, is that true? You would smoke as you...
Yeah, you see a picture of him and there's like a guy stops, lights up and keeps riding.
Oh, they would do it on breaks. I was having a hard time imagining them, you know, some French guy with Gauloises between his teeth, like on the bike.
I feel like I've seen it, but maybe it was just a publicity shot.
He, you know what they say, like strychnine before liquor, never sicker or whatever.
Red skies at night, sailor's delight.
So you know, he's now full of rat poison and brandy. And the race officials are describing his condition like this. His eyes were dull, lusterless. The ashen color of his face and skin had deepened. His arms appeared as weights, well tied down. He could scarcely lift his legs. So this guy's heading for the finish line in this, you know, drugged condition. He's hallucinating. He now thinks he's back at the beginning of the race. He's on nothing but brandy and egg whites. You know, he's having the worst day. And there's still two hills to go. He walks up the last one and then jogs down. And by the time he gets to the stadium, he's just like barely, you know, he's walking like Don Amici. He's some super old man. They lift him up and like two guys are lifting him and carrying him across the finish line.
Like on their shoulders or they're carrying him so his toes are touching the
dirt? Yeah, I think he's still sort of nominally moving his legs like with some very murky understanding of the rules here. They're like, look, he's still running. And he's awarded, you know, he crosses the finish line in that condition and just collapses and is like on the ground for 4 hours while doctors work on him. But on the plus side, he won the 1904 Olympic marathon. And he went back and he ran marathons again. So apparently he recovered.
Wow. So, what a story of triumph.
Exactly. A real triumph of the human spirit that you can just eat rat poison and brandy for an hour and totally dehydrate yourself. And
but you presume that he, I mean, nobody was surviving on their income as a marathoner at this point. He's a regular guy. He's probably working in a print shop or something.
He's got a job, you know, he's working at a construction site or, and that was true. These were all amateur athletes at the time. I mean, with very few exceptions, there probably were no professional celebrity athletes, right? Like a few boxers, maybe, like who's making a living at sports in 1904, you know?
What were the sports? I guess crew. What were the other sports? Oh, well, there was baseball and football by this point, but not really professional.
There were professional leagues, but I'm sure in the off season, even like, you know, these big baseball stars were off at a, you know, being lumberjacks in Oregon or something, right? I mean, I just assume it was not a career.
Yeah. If you played for the Yankees, it was like, you got three hots and a cot.
Yeah. The only well-paid athletes were like racehorses, you know, like Man-O-War or whatever, you know, he was the best treated athlete of his time. Nobody was giving that guy rat poison, I bet.
Or sailboats. I bet racing sailboats, although it probably didn't earn any money. You had to be a rich person in the first place. You probably got a crystal goblet.
Yeah, it's interesting. Were these all rich people, you know, doing these things in their free time, like our Sarasota golfer and, you know, I'm sure in some sports it was.
I mean, who has time?
Or were they
time?
Just blue collar?
Who has time to sit around? I mean, maybe the weightlifters were just guys that worked in a steel mill.
That's what I'm thinking. Like all these rich people, most of them couldn't have been in shape for the real sports. It probably divides by whether you actually need to have any kind of level of fitness.
Right.
And if you don't, that's a sport of the rich.
Right now, there are giant cockroaches in the future who are also golfers who are super mad that you are impugning the reputation of golf as not a real sport.
Oh, maybe golf's a real sport. I don't know. You're right. I would sort of include golf on that list.
But you don't have to really be in any kind of shape to golf.
Doesn't golf barely exist now?
You can be a giant cockroach we just established.
Like, what are the odds that there's golfing in the post-atomic age? Like, I feel like golf sort of seems old-timey now.
We have to ask about sport, like, which ones are obvious? Like, running is obvious.
But that's not necessarily true. Like, I feel like tug of war is one of the most obvious sports. Yeah, get a bunch of guys together, see who can pull the other one on a rope. And at the time, I think tug of war actually was an Olympic sport. You could get a medal for tug of war.
I mean, I remember in elementary school, we had tug of war during field day. Didn't you have tug of war?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's huge. It's like what they said about soccer for many years, you know, because fifth and sixth graders were doing it, eventually it was going to catch on. But it never happened at tug of war. Tug of war is huge in the fifth grade. That doesn't mean we're all watching tug of war on ESPN.
I bet you there's a tug of war channel. I bet you there is when you get up into the 800s on your cable.
Like ESPN Quattro. It's when it's all that World's Strongest Man stuff. Like, then this guy's going to throw the stump. I guess they don't have tug of war there because it's a team sport. You never see is there any singles tug of war?
Like,
or mixed doubles, like just a guy and his wife out doing tug of war against the Johnsons.
I mean, you remember there was an entire Sylvester Stallone movie about arm wrestling.
Yeah. Over the top, when arm wrestling was briefly on every lunchbox. I often think back about past trends like that, and I wonder, was that actually a thing, or was somebody just trying to make it a thing? Like, does over the top exist because arm wrestling was briefly popular,
or vice versa?
Yeah, was somebody trying to get arm wrestling over?
I mean, you think about top, mechanical bull riding. Which was also a
one movie phenomenon,
but a big thing at the time. And I think that mechanical bull riding, it started right at Gilly's Bar in somewhereville, Texas, Dallas, probably. It was one bar that had this mechanical bull.
Did they have some like mad scientist type in the back who had built this thing and nobody knew what it was?
Well,
like,
maybe it was actually
Radio Shack nerd is like, hey, it's like riding a bull, but we can put it like by the pinball machine.
Maybe they invented it to train actual bull riders, but these guys were the first ones to put it in a bar.
I see. It's like a training device.
Yeah.
And these guys get it recreationally.
Be like a bar that was full of rowing machines.
That's going to be my next thing. Come on down to the Coxman. It's a gay bar. Well, the funny thing is the marathon started out like that too. You know, it was just one of these, hey, this is going to be a thing. We'll make people run 26 miles.
Right.
And maybe that's why these guys are using it as a scientific experiment because, you know.
What happens?
The limit of human achievement. We've never actually seen anybody run 26 miles, you know.
What happens if someone runs 26 miles and we follow them in a car shooting them with arrows?
Yeah, that was the next year. We're getting ahead of ourselves. But it's funny that the marathon actually has become not just an established part of sporting culture, but a hobby.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure we all have, you know, a half dozen friends who run marathons and half marathons.
I know too many people that run marathons, even seemingly normal people.
So maybe it worked. All, you know, if not for these mad scientists, you know, testing the limits of human marathon running with their strychnine and dust clouds and no water stations.
But it seems like this is in the category of ancient memes that you invent and profit not at all from.
It's true.
Right? Like nobody got rich promoting marathons as a early 20th century meme.
Is there marathon merch? Like,
There's definitely like
the bumper stickers
marathon culture of water bottles and like little shorts that wick away sweat, right. but
whatever you put on your nipples so they don't bleed.
But it can't be a $1 billion industry.
There's no way. And plus, you know, anybody can make a bumper sticker. Like you can't copyright the number 26.2. That's the genius of that. There's no.
You know,
there's no intellectual property for a fraction.
I have to wonder about, you know, this is kind of like the Da Vinci. Perfect ratios or whatever. We all, in music, we talk about a 3-minute pop song as being precisely the limit of a human attention span.
That's what the brain craves.
Yeah. 3 minutes. And if you go over 3 minutes, you're giving them too much. If you go, you know, anything between 2:15 and 3 is right in the sweet spot of making people want to hear it again.
Hitchcock used to say movie length would be related to the capacity of the human bladder. Like he also believed there was a physiological component.
Hmm. And I wonder 26.2, what perfect ratio that represents. I mean, beyond the fact that the queen wants to be able to hear her crying baby.
It's just a coincidence. It's where the battle was, you know, if Plutarch is to be believed.
Right.
The funny thing is today, now that marathon running has become a hobby, it no longer seems like a superhuman, you know, achievement for our best and fleetest of foot. So there actually is a movement, I think, among many elite marathon runners to actually change the marathon, to make it 30 miles or, you know, to make it more of an elite thing. And there's all these other sort of punish yourself, strychnine kinds of events now, you know, double marathons and I'm going to run
100 milers.
Sure. And I'm going to Ragnaroks and I'm going to run 90 miles in a day and a night and a day, or I don't even know how these things work, but it does seem to just be made up to make a marathon for marathoners, you know, something that seems like a marathon, even if, you know, a marathon is something your sister can do now.
Well, you know, our culture spends so much time trying to dismantle elites, but in this instance,
we're
really encouraging people to make it more and more elitist. I am never going to run a marathon, Ken. It's one of the things I can say pretty confidently.
There are people who do. There are people who never run marathons, and then in the middle of their lives,
they decide
I'm going to start training
What about you? Do you keep it in the back of your head? Like one day maybe I'm going to be the Cuban bricklayer who cuts the bottoms off of his pants and runs 26 miles?
When I'm running, you know, Green Lake by my house, you know, if I'm running a 3-mile course, you know, I never think I would love to do this 8 or 9 times in a row, you know? But that's marathoners don't either. Like even when you're training, you never do a full marathon until the day. Like,
really?
I think that's true. You get up to like 18, you know, you run up to 3/4 of a mile and that's it. Like, it's just so bad for you that right. You don't want to do it any more than necessary.
You don't even want to put it in your brain what it feels like. It's just like, oh, it's just like 18 miles, except a little bit
and then
more.
You got to do that thing you barely did once and then just run for 8 miles.
Yeah.
You know, back to back.
At that point, you're almost there.
I guess you don't want to use it up in rehearsal. You know, you want to save something for the day.
Right.
So, you know, I'm sure it's not as out of reach as I feel like it is. But, you know, when I run 3 or 4 miles and I feel very tired, I never think, hey, let's do this like 5 or 6 more times.
Yeah. I never run 3 miles. But I injured myself as a young man, so I can't run like that.
What if you had a nest?
If there was a nest 18 miles away?
Yeah, what if they tell you, hey, there's a really good nest at the end of this path?
I might be tempted. Well, that concludes the Olympic Marathon of 1904. This is entry number 865.1C 0924. In the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, giant Futurians.
They're giants now?
I'm going to have to assume that in order to survive.
They've become megafauna, like those giant beavers that lived in the Ice Age or whatever.
I feel like by the time you have reinvented the technology to listen to our gold discs, you also would have to be big enough to, like, tote them.
I wonder if marathons would increase, size would increase if people's stride was longer. You know, if these giant futurelings can run a mile in, just a minute because it's like 50 steps to them. You know?
Right, or they may skitter. They may be like, what is this running? We skitter 26 miles.
Sure, they probably evolved faster ways to go than running. But maybe they would still do it as a throwback thing. I mean, we still have the car, but we don't watch, we still let people run in our televised races.
Yeah, absolutely, right? It could be like vintage car racing to them. I mean, cockroaches are pretty fast for their size. Imagine if they were, although I guess there would be some structural problems if they were 6 feet tall.
Let's not assume they're insectoid. Like, that might be a little racist. Then maybe the insects are their enemies. Maybe these are the people cowering from the insects in their caves, and our gold records are the only entertainment they have.
Right. I'm sorry. It's absolutely true. If I was triggering you by talking about giant cockroaches and you are in fact a giant sentient piece of cheese.
Who hates cockroaches.
Yeah. Or like I'm going to hope that they're like Ents. Big trees, slow moving trees.
They're probably befuddled by our hour of talk about long distance running then.
Right. Well, but maybe in order to enjoy our program, they have to slow the recordings way down and our voices are super deep. And it seems like we're talking about something that's happening very slowly.
If that's the case, we really don't have to do two of these a week.
Well, all right. Now, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, tweets are archived at Omnibus Project or at Omnibus Project. Our handles in our day were at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick. I also maintained an Instagram account under the same name, which Ken believed was beneath his dignity. Our address for email, which was a popular form of written electronic communication, was theomnibuspodcast@gmail.com.
Future listeners, we, John and myself, live in a turbulent, eventful time. We don't know what the future holds. There's much we don't know. We don't know if we're speaking to giant insects, giant blocks of cheese, wise, stately, tree-like creatures who move a millimeter a year. We have no idea what the future holds. In fact, we hope and pray that the dire future we imagine may never exist. If it comes soon, this may very well be the last time we speak to you, but we hope that's not true. We hope to be back with you very soon for another entry in the Omnibus.